Is that fair to talk about somebody's minister? Well, gosh, I didn't make the rules. Somebody else did. So I guess we'll be doing that come next week. We've got a couple of days worth of stuff to talk about on Mr. Parsley and his great relationship with Mr. McBush, McCain, whatever he's doing, John Sidney McCain III. We'll have lots to talk about next week on that. So I do want to thank all of you for joining us this week. It's been a good week for me, and I hope it was good for me. Was it good for you? Thanks for joining us here on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. Don't forget, we are a listener-supported program, and we could use your assistance right now. I know everybody's out to raise some money, but it's that time of year, and we need to as well. So thanks for listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thanks to Billy Shears. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I had a whole show planned today. I was going to have Cliff Schefter come on and talk about the real John McCain, and I will have that show. I will certainly have Cliff Schefter on in the future, but while I was preparing for that show, I got an email from someone who, well, probably hadn't emailed me in 5 or 6 years. He was, I can give his name, he deserves credit, his name's L.J. Carusone, and he and I and two others back in 1998 and 99 formed a group in California called Marriage Equality California. You may not know, I don't talk about it that often, that I was a trial lawyer in California for a number of years before I came out to Washington, D.C., before Bush v. Gore radicalized me and made me switch coasts. But I am a duly licensed and trained California lawyer. I practiced law in the California courts for a number of years, and I was somewhat active in California local politics. And one of the things that LJ and I did, we formed this organization to challenge California's marriage laws. And, of course, LJ emailed me to let me know that victory was ours, that today, just about 3 or 4 hours ago now, the California Supreme Court has ruled that it is unconstitutional under the California Constitution to not let an individual marry the person of his choice. If consenting adults want to get married, they are allowed to do so whether or not they are gay or straight. In doing so, the court said it exactly right. This is not a question about same-sex marriage. I saw all the press after this talking about the decision. Oh, the right of same-sex marriage has been found in California. No, no, no. This isn't about same-sex marriage. This is the fundamental right of an American citizen to marry, whether that citizen be straight or gay. Should all American citizens have the right to marry, or should only straight American citizens have the right to marry? This is discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and the California Supreme Court ruled that sexual orientation, like race, like gender, like religion, is a suspect class, and requires a compelling interest to discriminate. The decision is actually broader than marriage. The California decision says that in the state of California, equal protection means exactly that. Equal protection under the law. And you can't discriminate against someone just because of their sexual orientation. It's actually an even broader ruling. Now, I can't claim to have read the entire opinion. I was on page 60-something when, my time ran out. I like to read these opinions slowly, to take them in, to kind of revel in them, revel in the victory that I played a tiny role in helping to occur. And I'll tell you about that role as we go through the broadcast. But the opinion and the dissents are 172 pages long. So you'll forgive me if I couldn't read all 172 pages, as well as, of course, calling my family, calling my colleagues, letting other radio stations know and that I could be a guest on this issue, and I probably will be. And, yes, I called back Cliff Schechter and told him that we're going to move that McCain story, which we're going to have. We're going to move that about a week or two. Why is this decision so important? Well, California, of course, is the largest state in the United States. 15% of the American population lives in the state of California. It's about, maybe not 15, maybe about 12%. I think it's about 36 million people out of 300 million. So 1 in 8 Americans live in California. Add that to Massachusetts, and now 1 in 6 Americans live in a state where there is a right of every individual adult to marry the individual of their choice. I had been working on this quite a long time. In fact, I am proud to say, though I guarantee you it won't be in many press articles because it's a little-known story, however, I have witnesses, I can confirm it, that I was the first person, along with a fellow Californian by the name of Jim Toledano, two of us worked together to draft the very first civil unions bill in California and the second civil unions bill in the country. After the decision in Vermont in 1998 inspired people like myself to realize that, you know, gay people can have equal rights to straight people. They don't have to live in perpetual second-class citizenship. That even though the United States Supreme Court in 1996 said, in effect, that straight people can have sex and gay people can't, in the infamous Bowers v. Hardwick decision, that they were wrong. And they were obviously wrong, and times were a-changing. In 1998, as I said, L.J. Corsoni and myself and two others, just four of us, for the entire big state of California, formed a group called Marriage Equality California. And we had the first marriage protest in the United States. It was a lot of fun. I remember this. We went down to the courthouse in Beverly Hills. I don't know why we chose Beverly Hills. I guess it was close to our houses. It was close to the gay neighborhood of West Hollywood. And, heck, Beverly Hills is a nice place to be. But we lined up lots and lots of men and women in the courthouse of Beverly Hills. And I should say that one of our four founders was straight. So this was a group of straight and gay people. It certainly wasn't only gay people. But straight and gay single people lined up in pairs. Some had been couples for many, many years. Others, like myself, you know, grabbed LJ. I think I married him, or tried to, that day. We'd line up in rows and tried to get marriage licenses, knowing very clearly they would be rejected. We did it on February 14th, 1999, on Valentine's Day. And I'm proud to say our tradition has remained every February 14th. From 1999 until this year, couples have been lining up in California, taking our little civil disobedience and making it grow. And it was all planned out in advance. I had told, in fact, you know, as a lawyer, I talked with the Beverly Hills court staff to let them know what was happening, that, you know, we wouldn't be violent, that we would be very peaceful, but that we would go in, we would sign the forms, we would insist on being married, and they would promptly stamp a nice big rejected stamp that we could then go out and show the TV cameras. None of us thought we would be married that day. But it was the beginning, and a very proud beginning it was. And within a year, as I said, Jim Toledano and I drafted a civil unions statute in California. Our thought went something like this. Across the nation, a lot of straight people, particularly religious people, were offended by the idea that gay people could get married because they thought of marriage as a religious institution. Now, it is true that marriage is a religious institution. It is a very old and ancient religious institution. Some religions allowed polygamy, others didn't. Many religions, the women did not have a choice in the old days. And in fact, until really the last 200-300 years, families would put people together in marriage, both at the level of royalty all the way down to the level of poverty. It was a family institution. Indeed, prior to the Married Women's Emancipation Act of 1917, married women couldn't own property of their own. They were seen as part of the corpus of their husband, the body of their husband. They were joined as one, and therefore the woman, well, she had no rights. In fact, there's many a story in the 19th century about married women who came into their own after their husband died, and even some suggestions that perhaps some of them had a role in that, because married women could own property as widows, just not as married women. So marriage has changed very much over the course of the ages. Whenever I am broached by fundamentalist Christians who ask me about and say that marriage has been a man and a woman for since the beginning of time, I remind them that in the Old Testament, many of the patriarchs had more than one wife. And so don't tell me that marriage between one man and one woman has been there from time immemorial. In any case, I'm very proud of the civil unions bill that Jim and I drafted. The point of that bill was to give gay people equal rights, to develop a separate but equal system. Recognizing, of course, that separate but equal is not the same as equal, recognizing that Plessy v. Ferguson, which said that blacks and whites should have equal but separate schools and railroad cars and water fountains, was not the same as being equal, wasn't as good as Brown versus Board of Education, but at the same time recognizing that separate but equal was a huge improvement over the situation as it then existed. At the time we wrote the bill, there were gay couples who literally had to stand outside the hospital door while one of them was dying. I can give you a very clear example, a woman that went to my synagogue. She had been with her partner for, like 20 years. She was from Texas, and her family never approved of her being gay. And her partner's family never approved of her being gay. And when my friend, this woman in my synagogue, I won't give her name because I don't know, I don't think she'd mind me telling the story, but I haven't specifically asked permission. But when her partner was dying, and she was actually in Texas, she'd been visiting the family when she came down ill, the family sequestered her from her wife of 20 years, kept her in the hospital, would not allow my friend and her partner for 20 years to visit her dying wife at all, and actually managed to convince a delirious dying woman to even change her will so that the family would get all her money. And my friend was left not just penniless, but even worse, unable to hold the hand of her true love as she died. That kind of pain, it's hard to imagine, I think, unless you see it in the eyes of someone you care about, or even someone you don't know very well. There are many, many examples of that. I can give you lots and lots of examples. A friend of mine in New Jersey who lost his partner to AIDS and therefore had to lose his house. Because if you're straight and you're married and you have a house with your husband or wife and one of you dies, the other one gets to keep the house. You can pass it on free of estate tax. Now, I'm a big supporter of estate taxes in general, but I do believe in a spousal exemption. You shouldn't throw someone out of the house just because their husband or wife died. But if you're gay, because you would have the same legal rights as roommates. And this isn't something you can contract away, my friends. You know, the right wing always said, well, you just sign a contract. No. You can't sign a contract to get out of the estate tax or Social Security. Other cases, of course, it still exists today where one partner earns all this living and Social Security, and if they were straight, the husband or wife would get the survivor benefits, but not if they're gay. There's some 1,000 marriage rights. In any case, Jim and I think, understood, particularly in a state like California, which is a fairly liberal state, but the idea of allowing gay people to marry was still fresh, still pretty new 10 years ago, that many Californians had no problem giving gay folks equal rights to straight folks. Many had no problem with religious rights, R-I-G-H-T-S. Many had problem with religious rights, R-I-T-E-S, this idea that marriage is a religious institution. And even though you could tell people till they're blue in the face that civil marriage is different from religious marriage, they just didn't get it. So I decided, along with my friend Jim, a fellow California lawyer, that the answer was, let's start with separate but equal. It's a lot better than gay people had originally. And we developed what I have to say was a pretty ingenious civil union statute. It wasn't that long. It was about 5 pages long. It's the first piece of legislation I ever wrote, by the way, folks. And I wrote the legislation, and all it basically said is wherever the word marriage occurs in the California statutes, it shall be substituted by marriage or civil union. And everyone who is in a civil union has the same right as marriages. And in fact, if you're in a civil union, it should be treated as a marriage for federal purposes as well. Pretty clear statute. And then I went and helped to elect the guy that I knew would pass that statute. I worked very hard in his campaign. His name was Paul Koretz. He was an assemblyman who represented the district that included the gay city of West Hollywood. And I worked very hard in the primary to get him elected and then the general. And the first bill he put out there, as he promised me, was this civil unions bill. And I am proud to say that the bill that I wrote, or I co-wrote, was California's first civil unions bill and the second civil unions bill in the nation after Vermont. And we decided that, you know, if we had to compromise, if full equality was too much to ask the legislature of California, then, you know, we would take whatever rights we could get. We were prepared to fight against the religious bigots. We weren't prepared to fight against the gay community. Lambda Legal Defense Fund is an organization developed from the idea of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Thurgood Marshall's terrific organization, the one that brought Brown versus Board of Education. And it was designed to get gay rights, both legally, both through the legislature and through the courts. As such, it's generally a good organization. But one of the things you'll learn when you work in politics, and it was a real eye-opening experience for me, was that many, many lobbying organizations, although they start for good reasons, they start in order to promote things they believe in, whether it be equality or a woman's right to choose or decriminalization of drug laws or the environment or gun control or things that we're against, the NRA or moral majority, things like that. But let's just talk about the ones that I support. Even organizations that I support, like Lambda, after a while, they need to perpetuate themselves. They need money. They need to raise money. They need to show the community they're doing good things. Lambda could not have two lawyers in California draft a bill that would revolutionize the lives of gay people in California because their names weren't on it. They lobbied Paul Koretz very, very hard. And given that his support was in the gay community, and this was organized gay community, he withdrew that very nice bill that Jim and I wrote and substituted a bill that gave 8 rights in its place. Our bill provided for all 1,017. I have not contributed to Lambda since then, and I never will. But Lambda also decided, because we called our civil unions, they would call theirs domestic partnership. And then they promptly put out a letter, a fundraising letter, praising all the work that they had done. Typical, typical. I've seen that, by the way, in many groups. I don't mean to just attack gay organized groups. I've seen it in virtually every lobbying group, where the lobbying group starts caring about perpetuating itself more than about the common goals. But the domestic partnership bill in California did grow from 8 rights. Then it increased to about 20 rights and about 50 rights. And finally, by 2003, the domestic partnership bill in California included almost every right that straight people have. Meanwhile, though, there was a proposition in California called Proposition 22. Another proposition that I worked very hard to fight against. But it was a proposition that said marriage is between a man and a woman. And all the religious right got out in support of that bill, and it passed pretty handily back in 2000. I don't think it would pass today. That becomes important when I talk about the decision. But it passed by about a little over 60%. Because I guess people who have rights don't often think about people who don't have rights. Much as the majority of whites across the nation, and certainly in the South, unfortunately, were not opposed to segregation because it didn't affect their kids. In any case, of course, you know, when you think about it, 40% of California did vote against that bill, and even if 10% is gay, that's still 30%, you know, three times that number of straight people. So obviously there are good, well-meaning straight people. But we lost that battle, but then the legislature slowly passed these rights, more and more rights, until that fateful day that you probably remember on the news in 2004 when people lined up on the streets of San Francisco to get married. Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, ensured that he will always be the mayor of San Francisco no matter what he does based on that ruling. The court struck him down based on this California initiative. And it was clear that Gavin Newsom had violated the initiative, but what wasn't clear is whether the initiative violated the California Constitution. And that's the decision that finally came down today. And as Bob Kincaid has said, I linger over a fine legal opinion like some people linger over a fine wine. Well, he's absolutely right. And it is a fine legal opinion. I'm going to post it on my website. I haven't done that yet. I'll do that at the end of this broadcast. And so let you read all 172 pages. And the best part about the decision is that it was decided the right way. You know, even sometimes a good decision like Roe v. Wade is decided on what I think are kind of questionable principles. I think Roe v. Wade should have been decided one way and not another way. And there's certainly no greater pain than reading an awful decision, such as Bush v. Gore, or just a couple months ago, the Indiana decision, the one that said that poor people don't have a right to vote unless they basically pay a poll tax, which I've talked about before. But this decision was enjoyable, really enjoyable to read. And it was based on the absolute right way to base it, on a decision in California in 1948 called Perez v. Sharp, the decision that struck down California's miscegenation statutes as unconstitutional. Miscegenation is race mixing. And California, up until 1948, had a statute on the books that said that a man and a woman of different races could not marry. It was all about preserving the white race. California in 1948 was the very first state in the nation to strike down a miscegenation statute, to say that this isn't about the right to interracially marry, because that's how the opponents said it. They said, should we have race mixing? Should we have a right of interracial marriage? It wasn't a right of interracial marriage. It was a right to marry an individual of your choice. That's how the California court phrased it back in 1948, and that's how the United States Supreme Court phrased it in 1967, when 19 years after the California decision, they struck down the remaining 13 or 15 states that still prohibited race mixing in marriage, in the famous case of Loving v. Virginia. In fact, regular listeners know that Mildred Loving of that case just died about a week ago, and I talked about her a week ago. Well, the logic of Perez, the logic of Loving, holds today. It's not a question of the right to marry someone of a different race. It's not a question of the right to marry someone of the same sex. It's the question of whether an adult should be able to marry another adult, another unrelated adult of his or her or your choosing. And I was really pleased to see that they based it on Perez. Because a lot of times, those that are opposed to equal rights under the law will phrase that right in the most restrictive way possible. You know, should blacks be able to go to white schools? Should gay people be allowed to marry each other? Should there be, you know, should there be a gay marriage right? There's no such thing as gay marriage. There's just marriage. And the question is, should gay people have it? Just like there's no such thing as interrace marriage is different from non-interrace marriage. The question is, should people be allowed to marry? Now, what's so interesting in this decision is how it deals with the question of religious marriage. Because, as I said, when I wrote the Civil Unions Bill, at that time, Jim and I made sure that my co-lawyer and I made sure that, you know, no religious marriage statutes were changed. The right of religious marriage is inviolate. If a Catholic church says you can only marry a Catholic if you raise your children Catholic, that is the right of the Catholic Church. No one's going to take that right away. And you can't marry another person in the Catholic Church unless you get some Catholic annulment. So we made it very clear there was a separation between civil marriage and religious marriage, and that's why we had the separation but equal, the civil unions. And I can't tell you how often now I hear people on the right who are speaking before children, for example, because, you know, everyone under 30, it's very hard to find people under 30 who are opposed to the right of gay people to marry. They just don't get it. They're like, what's the problem? It doesn't bother me. Just as it's unfortunately hard to find people over the age of 70 who support a legal right of gay people to marry. It's very much an age-related issue. But I have debated Republicans before groups of high school students and college students before. And they'll say, you know, I'm okay with civil unions. I just don't want the right to marry because that's a religious principle. So the California Supreme Court took that argument head on, and they said if the legislature wants to call it something else, civil unions, domestic partnerships, and apply it equally to all its citizens, we have no problem with that. But we do have problems with treating citizens differently based on sexual orientation. And what's so fascinating about this decision is that in many ways they went one step further than Vermont or New Jersey. They went, in fact, as far as Massachusetts did. Because by 2003, California pretty much had issued the same separate but equal stuff that Jim Toledano and I had tried to put forward 4 years earlier that the gay rights organizations had taken down. The domestic partnership statute of California by 03 and 04 was, particularly by 06 when they included the tax provisions, pretty much included all the rights. In fact, the court, if you read the decision, had to struggle to find 9 points of difference where domestic partners still didn't have the same as marriage rights. There's about 1,009 of the 1,018 rights that were there. And so the court went and addressed the last question, the most direct question, and that is whether separate but equal is inherently unequal, the Brown versus Board of Education question. They said, you know, we admit that pretty much California domestic partners have the same rights under state law, not under federal law, under state law as they do, as straight couples do. There's some 9 differences. We could get rid of those 9 differences. The question is the name. The question's over the name. Now, 10 years ago, people like me, we were willing to concede the name. Separate but equal was a lot better than separate and unequal. So call it civil unions, fine. The real thing is it matters for people's families. And the right was saying, hey, you know, they just want validation. And really, most people wanted the rights. But this court, like the Massachusetts court, took it one step further and said that separate is not equal. Let me read to you from the decision. And as I said, the decision is, with all its concurrences and dissents, is 172 pages long. Don't worry, I won't be reading all of that. But let me just read to you what I think is the heart of the opinion. The Supreme Court writes, a number of factors lead us to this conclusion that couples should not be discriminated against based on their sexual orientation. By the way, this is, of course, the California Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court. First, the exclusion of same-sex couples from the designation of marriage clearly is not necessary in order to afford full protection to all the rights and benefits that currently are enjoyed by married opposite-sex couples. Got it? That's my addition. Permitting same-sex couples, they wrote, access to marriage will not deprive opposite-sex couples of any rights and will not alter the legal framework of the institution of marriages, because same-sex couples will have the same duties and obligations of marriage as opposite-sex couples. Now, this very obvious point is one that seems to always elude those who don't support the right of gay couples to marry. I remember a debate that I had. I should find it and play it sometime in honor of this decision. Right here on the horn, I can find it somewhere. I really should find that, because I had a debate in a church in Simi Valley, California. Simi Valley, by the way, is the valley from which it's a very, very white county that borders Los Angeles County. It's the valley from which the cops that beat up Rodney King came from, in fact. It's a very conservative white suburb of L.A. And I was in a church where, let's face it, at the beginning, most of them opposed the right of gay people to marry. I'm proud to say that after the debate, it was clear to me from the audience that most of them supported me, which was nice. But I remember Proposition 22, and I remember the arguments for and against it, because, you know, you see these California initiatives. This is a Western thing. Those of you that live in the West know what I'm talking about. The West has these initiatives and referendums where they have direct democracy, where they put it on the ballot and the people vote, and I can't think of any state that has more direct democracy than the state of California. And the people there directly vote. Well, I was in a debate on Proposition 22, and I remember reading the voter's guide. They have these little booklets where proponents of the proposition, they put their side in, and opponents put their side in. One of the proponents of Proposition 22 was a self-described 22-year-old female college student who said that she was having trouble finding a husband and that Prop 22 will protect the institution of marriage. And I remember saying in that debate that apparently this young girl is under the misimpression that all men are gay, because she's having trouble finding a husband. And if we don't allow gay people to marry, that because all men are gay, then some of them will go and marry her. And there was a lot of laughter in the church, but I had to remind her that, no, I believe that sexual orientation means that actually there are some people who are attracted to the opposite sex. I don't think that the institution of marriage will wither on the vine. And I remember asking people in the room, how many of you are married? And a lot of the people in the room raised their hands. And I said, all right, keep your hands up if you will divorce your wife or husband if gay people are allowed to get married. And every one of them took their hands down. It's an obvious point. Why is it that people are so anxious to control the private lives of others? I don't even understand interracial marriage. If you hate black people, don't marry one. If you're a racist bigot, that you've got serious problems, but I'm not going to force you to marry someone of an opposite race. I promise. And you may not even be attracted to someone of an opposite race, and I don't care. That's your choice. And no gay activists, no matter how radical, are going to go around forcing straight people to marry people of the same sex. It ain't going to happen. Don't worry about it. So this court got that basic point. But here's the greater point that the court got that I was very impressed with. Let me read on in the decision. Second, retaining the traditional definition of marriage and affording same-sex couples only a separate and differently named family relationship will, as a realistic matter, impose appreciable harm on same-sex couples and their children, because denying such couples access to the familiar and highly favored designation of marriage is likely to cast doubt on whether the official family relationship of same-sex couples enjoys dignity equal to that of opposite-sex couples. It's very interesting to me because I remember the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision, where those that were defending segregation said, but the schools are equal, but the schools are equal. And then there was this famous study, the psychological study, that's part of Brown versus Board of Education. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend that decision, which showed that in the 1950s, African-American children were asked to choose between dolls that were white or black. The white kids chose the white dolls. Okay, that makes sense. People want dolls that look like them. The African-American kids chose the white dolls, too. Chose the white dolls, too. In the 1950s, the majority of black children rejected the black dolls and played with the white dolls. That, to me, is so powerful at a gut level. At a gut level of the pervasiveness of racism. And they said separate is not equal. Not at all. Not when people believe themselves to be inferior. And that was the next point of the court. The court writes, third, because of the widespread disparagement that gay individuals historically have faced, it is all the more probable that excluding same-sex couples from the legal institution of marriage is likely to be viewed as reflecting an official view that their committed relationships are of lesser stature than the comparable relationships of opposite-sex couples. And finally, retaining the designation of marriage exclusively for opposite-sex couples, providing only a separate and distinct designation for same-sex couples, may well have the effect of perpetuating a more general premise now emphatically rejected by this state that gay individuals and same-sex couples are in some respects second-class citizens who may, by law, be treated differently from and less favorably than heterosexual individuals or opposite-sex couples. So it's pretty clear and pretty strong. Now, the first question when you're confronted with a strong legal decision such as this one is, what's the religious right going to do? How are they going to try to get rid of it? And fortunately or unfortunately, it's a lot easier to modify a state constitution in the West than it is in the East. The Eastern states, based on traditional ideas of legislation and legislators being sovereign, make it very, very hard to overturn a constitutional decision of the state Supreme Court. In Massachusetts, it requires two votes by the legislature in two successive legislative sessions of more than 25% more of the legislators, and then it goes to the people. So they got to do it, vote on it, wait 2 years, vote on it again, and then it goes to the people, and that's how you amend the Constitution in Massachusetts. And as you can expect, the Massachusetts Constitution is fairly short and not amended that often. The Western states are just the opposite. The Western states believe in referendum. They believe in initiative. They believe that the direct democracy. And ever since 1911, California has been able to amend its constitution through the vote of the people, a simple majority vote. California's constitution is 111 pages long because it's been modified so often. So this matter will undoubtedly go to the voters of California to make the final constitutional decision. And I happen to think the voters of California are quite different today from the way they were 8 years ago. I think they're going to vote to uphold the decision. I want to continue in talking about this and also give you a chance to call in at 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. But first, I want to interrupt for a little break to let you know something that I will be doing this weekend. And to tell you about it, I want to invite on the line Mona from Washington, D.C. Mona, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hello there, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am great. You know, listen.
Tell our listeners about the election forum this Saturday.
The election forum will be taking place at Greater Mount Calvary Holy Church in D.C. for the express purpose of empowering voters to select who they believe is the best candidate who deserves their vote. I'm really excited about the opportunity to have you involved. And
I'm excited about the opportunity to be involved.
Yes, I think people are really going to catch a hold of some information that they might not get with the sound bites that we tend to get from mainstream media. So that's our goal. We just want to make sure people have a more intimate look at the candidates and then discuss some issues that are not regularly discussed on mainstream television.
Yeah, one of the things I'm going to discuss is something that my listeners know well about, and that's the Indiana Supreme Court decision that basically took away poor people's right to vote. A really, really awful decision that we've talked about here on the Head On Radio Network, and I'll be talking about that in the larger Washington, D.C. community. But there are other issues as well. In reading your pamphlet, they're going to talk about the role of the black church and Jeremiah Wright. You're really going to get some tough questions, huh?
That's right, Mark. We will be talking about how the influx of negative attention surrounding him and his church and Senator Barack Obama, how that has an impact, if any, on the African-American church at large. We're going to delve into how race matters in this political race this year and so many other things. But what's the value of the evangelical vote? The evangelical vote was key in the last election. And so we're going to see from our panelists and from the people, from their perspective, if they believe that the evangelical vote is being devalued or
it's fascinating to me how white evangelicals vote so differently from black evangelicals. And it'd be nice to talk about what the Democratic Party can do to get more white evangelicals in at the same time as keeping the very strong African-American base.
I think one of the things Barack Obama has attempted to do is just that and express that being Republican is not synonymous with being Christian or vice versa, that there are
that is certainly the truth.
That they are, and you know, we are not naming any particular candidate that we're endorsing, but that's really important. For years, it seems that the Republican right has suggested openly or implicitly that if you are not Republican, you can't possibly be Christian.
One other thing I want to talk about when I go there, Mona, is the prosperity gospel, this idea by some on the religious right that basically God hates the poor, which is a direct refutation of Jesus and Sermon on the Mount, and yet that's what a lot of preachers are teaching people these days. So we'll have a lot to talk about. Give people the details of where is the church and what time and everything.
The church is at 610 Rhode Island Avenue in Northeast D.C., from 5 to 6, we're going to have voter registration. We'll have people, they're helping you with your voter registration, but forms will be available until 9 p.m. So you can come through and register to vote. And then beginning at 6 o'clock, our program will have several components, the most exciting being the God and Government Forum, which Mark will be participating in. And also we have Bishop Harry Jackson, who is a conservative author and the pastor of Hope Connection Church, and Reverend E. Terry Lavelle. She is also a person in ministry and the director of the DNC's Faith and Action Department. So I will be moderating and offering questions up from our audience, and it's going to be a discussion that is very important to you if you are a person who is interested in this race and who understands the importance of it this time. So
I'm looking forward to it. And I'm glad you came on and told people about it.
I'm sure you're going to raise a lot of eyebrows, Mark.
Oh, I'm sure I will. But, hey, I like raising eyebrows. It's part of what I do. Thank you, Mona, for coming on and telling us about it. And I do want to encourage listeners who live in the Metro Washington, D.C. area to check that out. And, heck, you can come say hello to me personally. I'd be glad to meet you. Thank you, Mona, for coming on and telling us about it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Appreciate it. So I'm getting back to my issue of the day, California's decision. And if you want to call in, by the way, to comment on anything I'm saying, you know I always welcome your calls. Maybe you think this is old news and it should have happened years ago, and it seems like after Massachusetts this is all sort of downhill. But I have to tell you, this is a huge deal. This is a very big deal. You know, once people start to see that Massachusetts is not some crazy state, that this is a trend, I think the states start falling piece by piece, state by state, as they did in 1948 when California struck down the miscegenation laws until 19 years later came Loving v. Virginia. When Massachusetts made its decision, I predicted right here on my radio show that in 25 years, every state in the United States will allow gay people to marry at the same rate as straight people, same rights, equal rights under the law. I still think that's true. I think we're proceeding apace. I predict that after California, New York will be very soon. New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont may switch from civil unions to marriage. Maryland is very close. Well, you know, we'll end up with the blue states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, probably Nevada, I imagine, will be the first red state, given its tradition of Las Vegas. And I think they'll come like this. In this case, there were 4 years between the first state and the second state, California, Massachusetts. I predict within 2 years, maybe even 1 year, we'll get to state three, and then we'll start getting more than one a year. It's really just a matter of time. And so this is a huge thing and a thing that I'm very proud about. And what I'm particularly proud about is the way this court structured its decision, saying, in effect, that this isn't a question of same-sex marriage. It's a question of individual freedoms, of individual rights, of the right of a person to marry the person of their choice. Doesn't seem that hard to understand. The other thing I really like about this decision is the fact that it does stem out of the miscegenation decisions, because I've always felt that those were the obvious choice. One of the things that the court pointed out that separates still, until this decision, those people in domestic partnerships from those people in marriages is the right to challenge the federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, this is very important. Let me recap. You may remember in 1996, in the year of his reelection, when Bill Clinton was pushed up against the wall by a bunch of bigots, and I'm convinced he didn't want to sign it, but he kind of felt like he had to. Again, that's not a good thing, but I understand, even if I don't approve, of the politically expedient fashion in which Bill Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, the Defense of Marriage Act, which of course occurred 8 years prior to Massachusetts' decision to be the first state to allow gay people to marry, the Defense of Marriage Act says that no federal rights will be conferred on people who marry who are not of the same sex, who are of the same sex. No federal rights will be conferred on gay marriages. People, I should never say that. People on gay couples who are married. Better. Got to watch that. I try never to say gay marriage, folks, because there's no such thing as gay marriage. Gay couples who are married. It's a bit more of a mouthful, but it's a better way to say it, because marriage is marriage. It doesn't matter who you are. But this decision, this law, this legislation is absolutely clearly unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional for a number of reasons. One, the Basic Equal Protection Clause, the one that California used. You're obviously treating gay people as less than straight people. But, you know, with this court, this Supreme Court, they're ready to treat gay people as less than straight people. They've been, you know, this is an extreme right-wing court. But here's something that the right wing should respect. Congress does not have authority to determine who marries whom. Congress has limited powers under the Constitution. They can declare war, even though that power has been usurped by this president. It can declare war. It can decide when money is printed. It can declare patents. It has a whole list of things it can do, decide immigration laws. Who marries whom ain't in the document. Conservatives, strict constructionists for years have been arguing that Congress is of limited powers, that the New Deal went too far, that the liberals are giving the government too much power, that Congress only has the limited powers in the Constitution. So here is where a good strict constructionist liberal like myself says, you know what, Scalia? You're right. You're right, Scalia. You're right, Thomas. Congress has no power to declare marriage. That belongs to the states. The 10th Amendment says whatever Congress doesn't have the right expressly in this document belongs to the states. States' rights. That's what conservatives claim they support. States' rights. So the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. I have a bet with a cousin of mine who's a lawyer, a bet that dates back to 1996, a bet that comes from when the Defense of Marriage Act became law. He said, now remember, this is before Bush v. Gore. He said, well, obviously it's unconstitutional. It's a violation of states' rights. Congress doesn't have the power under the Constitution. The conservative justices will have to strike it down. And I said, no. The conservative justices care more about bigotry than legal jurisprudence. Scalia and Thomas and Rehnquist at the time, Kennedy, they claim they care about strict constructionists. They claim that they're against judicial activism. They claim they believe in a limited government and limited constitution and states' rights, and they say all those things. But when their states' rights rhetoric comes up against their bigotry, the bigotry will prevail. And my cousin said no. He said he'll bet me. He said Scalia will vote to strike down that law because Scalia believes in textualism, strict constructionism. He knows there's no right of marriage in the Constitution. He's for states' rights. He has to strike it down to be consistent. And I said Scalia is more of a bigot than someone who's consistent. So this hasn't come to the U.S. Supreme Court yet. I think gay activists, frankly, are afraid to bring it to the U.S. Supreme Court. But when it does, we'll see whether I win or lose my bet. I, of course, hope I lose my bet. I hope that Scalia will put his legal principles ahead of his bigotry. But I think, unfortunately, that I'll win. California citizens, prior to this decision by the California Supreme Court, did try to challenge the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. They said, we are in a domestic partnership, and we want the federal rights of marriage that we're supposed to get, and the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. And the California court said, no, you can't challenge it. Separate ain't really equal. It's unequal. You're not in a marriage. The Defense of Marriage Act doesn't purport to deal with domestic partnerships. Words matter. You can't challenge it. One of the fascinating things that the California Supreme Court did today was hold that now the Defense of Marriage Act can be challenged because gay couples will be considered the same married as straight couples. Now, that's true in Massachusetts, too. I can tell you this. Gay activists are scared, and rightfully so. They're afraid of the Supreme Court. They know the Supreme Court may not uphold the Constitution. They feel like they should not try it now and wait until we have a Democratic president and a few better justices. And I disagree. I think they should bring it up now. And even if they lose, we'll just try to overturn it later. The future is ours. Equality is ours. It's on its path. America is getting it. And the next big step won't be in the courts. It's going to be in the California electorate. Because there's no question that those who want to overturn this are going to try it in the ballot box. You know, they tried it in Massachusetts. They didn't get the 25% of the legislature necessary to put it on the ballot. Got to love a place like Massachusetts where Republicans and conservatives can't even get 25% of their legislature. Wow, what a glorious state. In California, you don't need the legislature. The people can do it. They need 8% of those that voted in the prior gubernatorial election. And the only difference between a state initiative and a constitutional initiative is the percentage of signatures you need to get on the ballot. Now, Proposition 22, the thing that says that only a man and a woman can get married in California, that was a statutory initiative. They only needed 5% to get it, but the people voted by majority vote. Actually, more than 60% voted, and it's part of the California statute books. But it's not a constitutional amendment, thank God. Otherwise, it would take a vote of the people to undo it. Now the California Supreme Court has made its decision. Within 30 days, gay couples across California will be married, including such wonderful couples as Del Lyon and Phyllis Martin. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. Women in their 80s who've been together for 50 years. I'm told they are going to be the first, which is terrific. 50 plus years they've been together, and finally they'll be able to get married. And then the California voters are going to have to vote on whether or not to take these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of married couples and tell them you must forcibly separate. That we, the people of California, have determined that we don't like who you're marrying. And even though we don't want you to determine who we can marry, we are going to control your private lives. You know, it's amazing to me. Kind of makes me think a little bit of slavery. No, it's not the same as slavery. But just the idea that white slave owners would never consider themselves being a slave at the same time as they're arguing that blacks should be slaves. There are some people who would never consider having some stranger tell them who to marry, who purport to control the marriage habits of millions of people. And literally will go to the polls and try to destroy the lives of millions of people. Reverend Sun Young Moon has only destroyed the married lives of, you know, tens of thousands. But a California voter will have the right to destroy the lives of hundreds of thousands. And it could be some stupid idiot like that young 22-year-old woman who 10 years ago claimed, well, I don't want gay people to get married because I'm having trouble finding a husband. You know, it's interesting, the social cost of all of this. And I don't just mean to gay couples. I mean to straights as well. If you're a regular listener of the Inside Scoop, you know I've done shows right after the Larry Craig affair on the very real aspect of straight people married to gay people. Particularly for people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, there are a lot of couples forced together by prejudice, where a straight person is married to a gay person. And oftentimes the gay person is cheating, and the straight person either knows or doesn't know. In the African-American community, it's called the down low. And it often leads to spreading of diseases and breakup of families. And the question I think to ask a fundamentalist is, would you want your own daughter to marry a gay man, assuming your daughter's straight? Would you want your straight son to marry a lesbian? No? Why not? Why not? And let them answer the question. Well, if gay men, you think, shouldn't marry any straight women, and gay men can't marry gay men, then who are they supposed to marry? And if they're supposed to not marry anyone at all and live a life of sexual promiscuity, isn't that, religious conservative, what you were complaining about in the first place? Basically, the rule is gay people should suffer for being gay. I mean, there's just no answer. And that's a good question I think you should ask any of your colleagues or friends who are opposed to the right of gay people to marry. Do you think that straight people should marry them? Do you think that you would counsel your own daughter or son straight to marry a gay person? It harms the straight community as well as the gay community. Lot asked in the chat room of a time limit to implement the decision. It is 30 days. It will be implemented in 30 days unless the court extends it, which I doubt. The constitutional amendment process will probably take, I don't think it'll be ready by November. I think it's going to have to wait till probably at least a year. They've got to gather up some 700,000 signatures, and even though the churches will pay millions of dollars for paid signature gatherers to get that,